this is going to be a pretty like intense session, but it's so important. So enjoy this as much as you can. Let me now introduce to the stage to the Attitude Mental Health Panel, the editor of Attitude Magazine, Matthew Todd.
Hello. Oh, I'm working. How exciting. Nice to see you. I always have music when I walk on or arrive anywhere into Lorraine's sitcom-like home. It's very nice. Thank you for being here. Can we just show our appreciation to everybody who organizes Student Pride, because they all do it for nothing. This is an amazing event just done by people who didn't have experience of doing it before, and it's amazing. So thank you to Tom and everybody. Love coming here. It's really, really positive. And us LGBT people get to talk, and it's not in a nightclub, and no one's drunk. Who knew we could actually do that? It's incredible. Amazing. What a new experience for most of us. Some of us are drunk. Hello, Kevin. Love you. Always rely on you, my darling. So this is a discussion, the Attitude Question Time panel discussion about mental health. And I just want to tell you why I'm involved. In 2010, when I became editor of Attitude, I realized that I had been dealing with some issues myself as I had been growing up, and kind of struggling a bit, talking to the NHS, talking to some gay charities. No one could really give me any answers. No one could really help. And then I started to find some answers, and I wanted to tell people. So in summer 2010, I wrote an article, 10-page article, called How to Be Gay and Happy, about why it is perhaps that there are studies showing that LGBT people have higher levels, not everybody, but quite a number of us, have higher levels of depression, anxiety, sometimes suicidal behavior thoughts, and so on. Sometimes addictive behavior, and why that might be. And we were a bit nervous about our attitude. We thought perhaps the readers might be offended or upset. It was as if we were saying, we've all got mental health problems, which isn't what we were saying. So we were nervous about it, but actually we got more letters in support of it than we've ever had over anything. More than 300 emails and letters to me saying, oh my God, that's my experience. We need to talk about this more. You're inside my head. Let's talk about it. So for the last 4 years, I've been writing a book, which is out in June, called Straight Jacket, How to Be Gay and Happy. And I'm very excited about it, and I hope you will like it. It's a difficult read, but I think it's important. And so today we're going to have a discussion with some people about this subject matter. So if you could hold your applause while I introduce the panel and then give them a big round of applause when they come up, that would be amazing. Unfortunately, Munro Bergdorf can't make it today, sadly. But instead, we have the founder of Nail Transphobia, Charlie Craggs. We have Taz Edwards-White, who's a mental health and wellbeing coordinator at Metro Charity, which is an amazing charity which I love. We have Bisi Elimi, who's a Nigerian LGBT rights activist and co-founder of Kaleidoscope Trust. We have Johnny Benjamin, who you might have seen we gave an Attitude Pride Award to last year, who's a mental health campaigner, vlogger, and author, and created the Find Mike campaign, which you might have seen in the media over the last couple of years. And we also have someone very, very special, someone we love very much, a pop star and mental health advocate and LGBT activist, the lovely Mr. Will Young. Would you please welcome our panel?
Hello.
This is Johnny. This is Taz. This is Bisi. All right, okay, fine. Welcome, welcome everybody. Hello, how are we all? Yes, I think we're in the right place. Are we in the right place, sound people? Apparently it's very important that we sit in the right place. The sound people can tell us if we're not, or you just won't be able to hear us. But we're all very pretty and you can just look at us.
I think we missed it.
Amazing, perfect. Okay, so I just want to give you guys and all of us a little bit of background info. There's a really, well, there was a really, really fantastic charity, which Will was actually a patron of, called PACE Health. And it's the UK's only LGBT-specific mental health charity. They are amazing. They've done some incredible work. I know many people have used their services. I've sent many people that way myself. Unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks, they've actually just shut because of government cuts, which is a really terrible thing to happen for London, for this whole country. It's a shocking thing. So it gives this an extra level of, seriousness, I guess, that PACE are no longer around. But for the last 5 years, they did research for a very important study, which was published last year, called the RARE Research Project. It was one of the most comprehensive studies of mental health in LGBT people. And some of their statistics they found were that young LGBT people under 26 are more likely to attempt suicide and to self-harm than their heterosexual and cisgendered peers. 34% of young LGB people had made at least one suicide attempt, compared to 18% of heterosexual young people. That's 34% for LGB young people, compared to 18% of heterosexual young people. 48% of young trans people had made one attempt at suicide, at least one attempt, compared to 26% of cisgendered young people, which is shocking to me. It's a really massive difference, I think. So let's start with Johnny. Why do you think that might be?
Well, from my own personal experience, you know, I grew up in a Jewish family, and I was constantly told that being gay was a sin. And, you know, to have that throughout your whole life, that, you know, being gay is wrong. And it's not just wrong, it's really bad, and you're going to go to hell for it, you know. What does that do to someone's mind? And, you know, I'm not trying to criticize religion, but I just think that, for me personally, you know, I saw suicide as, I'd rather have killed myself than have come out, because I was so ashamed and I felt so embarrassed about my sexuality, and that death, that not to be here anymore was the easier option. And that's so sad that people think that, you know, that they'd rather not live than just be their true selves. And the thought of telling my family, and, well, particularly my family, that I was gay, yeah, it just did not bear thinking about. And I know I'm not alone in having those deep fears and the turmoil that you go through, because you're so terrified about coming out and the reaction you're going to get. It can lead to suicide, you know. It's really sad.
Could you just tell us a little bit about, for people who might not know your story, just very briefly about how you came to be talking about these issues?
Sure. So 2 years ago, in 2014, I launched a campaign to. When I was 20, I went to a bridge. I went to a bridge in London. Was about to jump off the edge, and a guy came along and basically talked me out of it. And 2 years ago, I launched a campaign to find him, really in order to raise awareness of mental illness and suicide. Just wanted to, you know, there's 17 suicides in this country every day, so really wanted to just, you know, get people talking about it. Never thought that we'd actually find him. And amazingly, this campaign went viral, and within 2 weeks, he came forward, and we were reunited. And we made a documentary following the whole search that's on Channel 4, if anyone wants to watch it, called The Stranger on the Bridge. Sorry for the plug. And now I'm talking about it. I give talks in schools and prisons and hospitals and workplaces. And my big passion is young people. So I've just launched a workshop in schools. I want every single pupil in this country to have mental health education. It's so important. 75% of mental illness begins in adolescence. So it does not make sense why we're not educating our young minds around mental health. You know, they teach them how to look after their bodies, you know, do physical education and sports, but why we're not, you know, looking after our young people's well-being is just beyond me. There's so much that in the last few years I've seen about mental health in this country that desperately needs to change, from the prison systems to the actual mental health system. If anyone's got an experience of using the mental health system in this country, they'll know how I can't swear, they'll know how bad it is. It's so appalling the way mental health is treated in this country. I think the stigma is decreasing, yeah, but mental health treatment and the way it's funded is just appalling in this country.
Absolutely. That's definitely my experience. We'll talk about that a bit more, I think. Taz, can you tell us a bit about your experience, or maybe of the kind of people that come to Metro with some of these issues? Well, and also want to make clear as well, and Johnny's campaign is for everybody, and of course LGBT people are by far and away not the only people who suffer from mental health problems and depression. It's a huge thing for lots of people.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately Johnny's story is really not uncommon at all. Like, I see anything from 6 people a day coming in feeling in crisis because they're not able to feel that they can come out or be themselves. And it's not, and I think a really big point that I wanted to make today was to separate mental illness from sexuality, sexual identity, sexual orientation and gender identity and any kind of trans issues. They're completely separate, and it's because of all the pressures, as you were talking about, with, you know, coming from a religious background, but it's not just religious backgrounds. I also work with some people who are refugees and asylum seekers as well, and have awful experiences growing up and torture and abuse and their houses being burnt down because they've been outed in within their communities. But even within this country as well, there's people who, you know, come out to their parents and then the parents just kick them out and, you know, disown them and they don't have any support. And just feeling really, really awful. Like, it just all goes within themselves and they just feel so helpless, you know. And it's just so ridiculous because, you know, it's who we are. So I don't really understand, you know, how... Anyway, so I've gone off on a tangent.
There's a kind of perception, something I hear all the time at work, is some many gay people say this to me and well-meaning straight people, that everything's fine now. Mm. This country isn't homophobic anymore. It's really easy. People are very accepting. What's your experience of the people who say that to you? And is it young people that are still coming with these stories?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, it's quite often young people. But even people that have been in, you know, tried to make a heterosexual life for themselves and been married for a number of years, and then feeling that they want to come out, are still being disowned and rejected by their families. But mostly and more often than not, it's young people that are having that experience. But the level of homophobia, I feel, you know, people do say, oh, everything's okay now, but I see a slight decrease within people's presentations of that experience, but it's only really because of the Equality Act and things. Now we've got laws to protect us within our country. That's the case that I feel. But I think people's personal experiences, if you don't fit into, you know, we're all taught when we're really small to, when you grow up, you're going to be heterosexual and you're going to marry a member of the opposite sex and you're going to get a house and a car and have two kids. And when you don't fit into that world, it can be quite scary because you think, where do I belong? So, yeah.
What's your experience of this? Do you think it's still hard for people to come to terms with being LGBT?
Well, you know, I think this very much is about layers, isn't it? And there's this part of this problem that actually been under researched in this country, and that is how mental health is affecting BME LGBT young people. Stonewall has done some work around that issue, but it's still the most under-researched, the most under-resourced in this country, that, you know, 3 in 4 black LGBT persons in this country have attempted suicide between the ages of 16 to 20. That is an epidemic, and nobody is talking about it. And, you know, most especially when it's come to the lesbians, the impact of, you know, suicide, drug use, being in abusive family to end up in abusive relationship is extremely, extremely high. And I think this brings about, you know, one, you have to first of all identify yourself. Am I black or am I gay or am I lesbian? Which a lot of white people don't have to deal with that, basically. And when you find out that, okay, in the scheme of thing, which one do I really want to deal with first? Do I want to deal with racism first? Or do I want to deal with homophobia first? The unfortunate thing is black LGBT people don't have the luxury of choice. So you cannot wake up one morning and say, you know what, today is Saturday and I'm just going to deal with racism. Because the point is, you might just step out of your house and the first attack you will get is homophobia. And you're not just going to tell them, you know what, I will feel about this tomorrow. Today I just want to feel about racism. So it's really a huge thing. And I didn't grow up in this country. And going back to what Ben was saying, I grew up in Nigeria where male masculinity is extreme. You know, you have to be a man. You don't have a choice. You cannot choose between, you know, middle ground. And that was why I watched First Date. Was it First Date on Channel 4 when somebody was talking about campness? You know, it's a strong stigma within the black African society, mostly within the black African gay community, for you to exhibit any trait of feminism, people will stigmatize you. So if you are feminine, you have to deal with that. You have to deal with the rejection. And there's also the burden, you know, for mostly for black male guy to be predominantly top because of the fact that they are highly sexualized. So there's that burden that, okay, well, but I'm not top. And I just, and people just feel like, no, but you're black. So there's a lot of things going on that as a community, sometimes I just feel that we're so consumed in our own little bubbles, we don't actually see that the burden of intersectionality is causing a lot of damage within the community.
Absolutely. Charlie, what's your experience? Why would do you think that the figures are higher, even more, for young trans people?
I think it's hard because not only are you facing hatred from outside, you're facing hatred from inside, or at least I was. Like, those of you who are in the audience who are here, I just did the last panel, so I've not been briefed on this, so it's all coming from the heart. But I really... was angry at myself for being feminine, like growing up and stuff. Like, obviously I identified as a gay guy first, and then at 21 I came out as trans. I don't like came out, I like accepted, because I'd really always known, like I'd known since I was like 4, and I just pushed it away because then there wasn't transgender. Like, yes, it existed, but it wasn't talked about in the media, and there was no trans people. The only time you'd hear about them would be on Jerry Springer or when they'd been murdered in the newspapers. So I didn't understand it and stuff. And when I came to understand it, they were the representations I saw. And I was like, I don't want to be this. Like, my life is hard enough as a gay guy. Like, and I was very suicidal. And it just got to the point where I just couldn't not be me anymore. Like, I knew that the only thing harder than not being me, though, would be being me. Like, I knew that that would be harder than repressing who I was. But then it just got to the point where I couldn't do that anymore. So it really kind of... back to your question, is just for me and for a lot of trans people, I think, is like this, like internalized transphobia or internalized like misogyny almost. Like, it can be the same with gay guys. Like, as a gay guy, I hate myself for my femininity because that's what I got really badly bullied for on my council estate and my all boys horrible school and stuff. Like, so I think that's, as well as the outside stuff, like, don't get me wrong, since transitioning I'm a lot happier, but my life's a lot harder. And transphobia and homophobia and racism, all these things exist, but sometimes the hardest kind of hatred to take is the hatred for yourself, because that's what you have to go to sleep with every night.
Absolutely. I think that's, yeah, certainly something that I have experienced, and a lot of young people and older people too that I speak to. I think that's a common thread that a lot of people feel, but I think maybe we haven't talked about it in the past because the gay rights movement was so... we were under so much threat and so many attacks from outside that we had to present this image of, it's great to be gay and then LGBT. And so it was almost as if we would let the side down by saying, actually, I don't feel very good about myself sometimes.
Yeah.
But hopefully things like this will hope to change that. Will, why are you here? I'm very glad you are. But and why did you become a patron of PACE?
Why
did you
feel it was,
why are you here?
I thought it was a Starbucks and I just walked in. I'm on the panel. I missed your other.
Why did you become a patron of PACE? Why was it important to you?
I think what I've noticed is, as a country, we've come so far in the evolution of LGBT rights for adults, and there's a huge gap now where we're ignoring young people. We've focused, I think rightfully so, on getting legal rights. And what I've noticed in witnessing statistics as the ones you read out earlier is there's a huge void where the government is not focusing on nurturing young LGBT people in schools. And the prime fault, I think, is that difference is not recognized in this country. I mean, we are basically all different. We cannot be the same. So to promote difference in schools will just allow everyone to grow up more accepting and loving. I've had 2 meetings with 2 different education secretaries where I also use the word epidemic busy in terms of the statistics. And the last one I had with Nicky Morgan, you know, I came away incredibly disappointed. The problem with homophobic language in schools is it's just simply not being addressed. And this is my primary focus now with young LGBT rights. And I think the what lies beneath that is people just don't think it's an issue. You know, there is still a latent homophobia in this country.
You were on Newsnight, weren't you? And they had Milo Yiannopoulos, who I think has been on the panel here. He's a very right-wing media commentator, gay man. And he was arguing against you, saying, it's fine, use the word gay in a negative way at school. Why is it
because,
bad?
Because we're talking about, we don't grow up with shame. Shame is put upon us. You know, a baby is not born with shame. What happens is, through this very subtle use of the word gay as meaning negative and derogatory, if I'm a gay young person, the shame is going to be hoisted onto me. And then, as Charlie was saying, it becomes internalized. And then it just becomes a downward cycle. Now, I might get to a place as a young person where I come out to friends and family. And as you were saying, you know, then we put on a front. We're like, yay, I'm out. It's all great. It's not, because that internalized shame is still there. If we don't tackle, if we look at the evolution of all rights in society, it's been the reclaiming of language. And this is a fundamental area that is being ignored in this country. And until that changes, there's just, and it honestly breaks my heart, there's going to be more and more generations of young LGBT people that are going to continue to have a lack of nurture and have this internalized shame, which happens, which can be changed within the education system. 63% of secondary school teachers don't think that it's a problem that someone using the word gay in a derogatory sense cannot be harming. And yet in 2012, a study of just over 1,000 young LGBT people found that 98% of young LGBT people found it distressing. So there's a mismatch. And I don't see the education secretary, who I'm not a huge fan of, at all. I don't see her addressing this at all. And my only conclusion is that I can draw is that she doesn't give a shit about it. And I will pick it outside. I'm actually augmenting a new white paper. And then I will pick it outside the Department of Education until she fucking gives me some answers.
Quite right. I think a few people will join you. Taz, that use of the word gay in a negative sense, is that something that the people, your clients, talk about? Is it something they have experienced and they say is difficult for them?
Because I don't think people actually realise, because we throw language around so much, and because I'm from like the mental health kind of side of things as well, that I see so much negative language used and derogatory language and unhelpful language used all the time by all of us at any time. And I think it's really important, because it does have a really negative impact onto those who are listening, and someone who might not be out and, you know, might not really be understanding, going through quite a journey with themselves and their identity, to start hearing words like such as, oh, that's so gay, or things used in a derogatory way, it's really detrimental to their well-being. It, you know, they'll take it on, and it just pushes them, you know, with that internalized shame as Will was just referring to, but it pushes it all inwards, and people don't feel comfortable to be themselves, so it can make you really unwell. And with the mental health side of things, you know, we all know about, you know, the mainstream media using words such as psycho and crazy and mad, and there's all these kind of derogatory terms that are used for people that aren't well, and that wouldn't be in the same way as within physical illness. You know, we wouldn't kind of be using those kind of terms. So it, to me, it doesn't make sense, but it, you know, I think we have to be really, really careful in schools, in unis, anywhere, within ourselves. And I often get, you know, talk to my friends, they get a bit annoyed. They think I'm a bit like PC all the time. Oh, you know, you're always going on about terminology and language. But it's so important. And yes, if you have got that understanding with your best buddy and you can call each other what you want within that confined space and you both have that understanding about it, that's great, and celebrate that and mess around and have fun and call each other queer or whatever, you know, and have a good time. But just be careful about the kind of language that you use around other people, and that's all that I would say really on that.
Is something that you campaign about, your language about mental health and how we talk about it and stigma and so on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's so important. It's so important. And the media, I think, have a long way to go. You know, when, for example, unfortunately, when Robin Williams took his life, the way the media treated that was disgusting. You know, if it had passed away from a physical illness, I don't know if anyone saw the front pages and the way they kind of speculated and the details they wrote down. And If he had passed away from a physical illness, it wouldn't have been treated like that. There's a long way to go in terms of stigma. As I said, stigma is getting better in this country, but you know, I think still a hell of a long way to go, particularly within the media. And it's so important because you know, if you're battling with your mental health and you see those kind of negative messages or language like psycho, you know, or crazy, or schizo, or you know. Of course, it's gonna prevent you from coming forwards and talking about it.
Or going for help.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly. It scares you. It scares you. You don't want to be labelled as different or you know, a psycho or crazy. So it's gonna prevent you from getting help. So language and stigma is something that we really need to tackle.
We're going to show a trailer for a film that came out last year called Chemsex in a moment. So I just want to warn you about that. It's quite intense, but I think we've established that as young LGBT people, we experience a lot of shame that's not necessarily our own. As Will said, it's kind of thrust upon us from other people's baggage. And I think there's always a narrative that if you come out, then everything's fantastic and everything's fine. I remember when Michael Barrymore came out, there was a gay journalist called Terry Sanderson, who I respect. He's an amazing writer, used to write for Gay Times a lot. And he wrote an open letter in The Guardian, I think, saying to Michael Barrymore, "Now you've come out, everything will be absolutely fantastic." And obviously for Michael Barrymore, we know that he then had a huge amount of problems. So I want to just talk about how that shame impacts us sometimes in our adult life, for some of us, not everybody. So could we show that trailer for the Chemsex film, please? Okay, so I just want to acknowledge that's a very, very intense clip, and you know, the experience of a small amount of people in London and outside of London as well. But certainly it's been really disturbing to me over the last 5, 6, 7 years that I've been aware of these things, to see that the use on the gay scene, people dealing really intense drugs like crystal meth and methadone and GHB, it's very, very easy, as David Stewart says. You know, you often young gay people come to big cities like London, and we go on Grindr or Scruff or Hornet or apps like that, and these drugs are being dealt. Now, it's not about demonizing drug use. That's a whole other discussion. I think it's fair to say that these drugs are very, very addictive, very, very powerful, and very, very dangerous. I'm certainly very aware of lots of people, friends of friends on Facebook, people who have overdosed, died using these drugs. So I do think there's a drug problem. So let's talk about drugs. I saw you nodding away, Taz.
No, only because that's just exactly my experience. And I think because I was born in London and I grew up in London, and I've been on the London LGBT scene since I was about 15, on and off over the years. And so from my personal experience and actually seeing. And you're absolutely right with what you're saying. You know, some young boys, they move from the countryside or around, you know, at the outskirts of London, or, you know, and they come to London. It's like, wow, you know, gay people and music and partying and clubbing, and it's going to be fantastic. And then London can be quite harsh. Sometimes it can kind of suck you in. And if you're not kind of aware or have that understanding about what these kind of drugs can do to you, then you can very easily slip into that lifestyle. And I've got lots of friends, unfortunately, that have, and lost friends, and yeah, so just don't do drugs.
No, I don't. Very,
well, don't do some drugs.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, my experience of kind of, you know, working with, you know, mental health professionals who work with the LGBT sector, everyone's a little bit nervous about saying don't do drugs, because there's this thing about older people. If older people say don't do drugs, young people are going to go, woohoo, I want to take drugs. So it's not, it's really hard, isn't it?
I think the best way is to kind of research what these drugs do to your body and how they affect you, and everything's really individual to you uniquely as a person, and obviously everyone's allowed to make their own decisions, their own personal choices. Absolutely. About how they live their lives. But it is, I think, just find out about what is actually, because also it can make you vulnerable and get you into these positions and situations that are really bad for your sexual health, really bad for your mental well-being, and make you really vulnerable. So that's all I would say about it.
You see, have you noticed drug use in young people becoming problematic in your experience? I don't know if you have experience of people that you socialize with or see.
Well, I've had opportunities of actually working with young people who, just like you said, and like you alluded to, who, not just so much under the pressure of, you know, wanting to have sex, but that is the only way they can be part of a community that they know. You know, you're kicked out of your house at the age of 17, you're homeless, you find yourself trading sex for a bed, and that bed comes with chemicals that you have to use, or else you're back on the streets. You know, chemicals becomes breakfast, lunch, and dinner for you, because you have no choice. And there are people that just felt like the only way I can actually be part of a community and be accepted is to be part of this. I don't really subscribe to the demonization of the use of drugs. I've used drugs. I've used alcohol. I guess that's the only drug that I've ever used in my life. And that is huge as well. But I think that one of the problems that we have is we are not having an opportunity to talk openly about the use of drugs and what it's doing to us, or question ourselves, look into our eyes and say, okay, when at that point I pick up the pill or I pick up that bottle of alcohol and I want to drink it for the sake of sex, what is it that I'm losing? You know, if you can't have sex sober, then there is an issue there, and this issue has to be addressed. But again, how will I take somebody on a journey to understand there is an issue? Because if you don't understand there is an issue, it's just like when I was going through my mental health, it took me over 15 years before I actually could come to a conclusion in my own personal life that, you know what, I've got an issue. And that was when I woke up in the mental health hospital at Lewisham. You know, I think my flatmate, my ex-flatmate, she's here, she saved my life. And it was just at that point, I just felt like, you know what, I've been trying to kill myself at the age of 17. I've not been successful. Maybe I should just stop killing myself and I should just leave it. But I came to a conclusion that I have an issue I need to address. And that's what I do. I talk to people who are using drugs. I don't tell them to say stop using it unless I have an alternative to fill, because there's a vacuum that the drug is filling. And if I don't have what is going to fill that vacuum, I don't think I have the right to take it away. I know it's unfair to say, but I need to be able to go on a journey with them to fill that space. Until then, this is what they have, and I can't take it away from them.
There's a really upsetting line in the film, I don't know if you could hear it in the room with the echo, where a commentator says the gay scene is such a lonely and isolating place. I just wondered if anyone who might agree with that might put their hand up, because I have certainly experienced that at times. Okay, that's interesting. Will, you put your hand up there. What's your experience of that, and why do you think it is, sometimes feels like it can be a lonely and isolating place?
I think it can be because I used to joke with friends.
friends that I would walk into a gay club and smell the self-hate, you know, in the room. And for myself, I couldn't deal with that self-hate. So if I can't deal with it in myself, I can't, you know, deal with it and handle it, you know, in other people. You know, I'd be on a train, and if there was a group of gay guys behind me, you know, I'd bristle, you know, because I couldn't handle it, because I hated myself for being gay. And I think it comes back to, there's a great book called The Velvet Rage, which when I had my breakdown, that was the first book that I read, and then I went on to John Bradshaw on shame and Pierre Melody on love addiction, and I was a love addict, still am a love addict, addicted to porn, certainly addicted to alcohol, and it was because it was masking and aiding with a huge void. I never went on a date without having at least two drinks before I left the house. I didn't even notice that as a problem. Drugs, I didn't really get into. I toyed around with it, but it just, you know, didn't really stick with me so much. But I think it comes back to that, everyone's trying to find their way, and there's stuff that is very painful to deal with if it's been hoisted on one for years and years and years. You know, from the age of 4, I knew that I was gay. I came out at 21. That's a lot of years of, I can't do the maths, what is it, 17 years? Of shame being hoisted on me. And I will keep on coming back to shame because it's such a fundamental thing. Until I could look at it, you know, I just kept on having sex to fill the void, looking at porn, shopping, anything. And I think the problem is that we are told that as soon as you come out, everything will be okay. It's just not the case, you know. And it is different being a young LGBT person, because if you're becoming sexual and you're heterosexual, you're not dealing with a huge backlog of sexual shame that is put on you, and shame with your identity. The other thing I will very quickly say is, you know, one of the differences with being gay is that you sleep with the same sex. So how do I find my identity? Well, I'm just going to sleep with the same sex then. Otherwise, who am I? And I think that's another thing to look at. What is it really to be LGBT? But that's something that you can't fast forward in young people. And I think, Busy, it was great hearing you, because I think I heard you say you talk about 15 years until you got to that place with yourself, and your ex-flatmate aided you and you realized you had a problem. It took me 15 years. I can't fast forward young people, but what I can ask them is to be interested in what their reasons are behind things. You know, I can go and have sex with someone and it's very healthy, or I can go and have sex with someone from a very unhealthy kind of place. So I just ask young people to be interested in their reasons and intentions behind it.
Yeah, that's good advice. I mean, in my experience, I came out when I was 16, and it was straight into a gay youth group with lots of quite intense people, some dysfunctional things happening, then went out to the gay scene. And I think actually what I really needed at that time was to talk about my experience, to talk about what it had been like growing up in shame in the closet, rather than just going out and getting completely pissed and dancing to Kylie, as fun as that was. And I want to acknowledge as well, actually, not all LGBT people have these issues, and the gay scene can be an amazing place. I had years and years and years of dancing around GAY until they knocked the damn thing down, and it was really, really good fun. But actually, I have to say, like Will, I was filling a void as well. I didn't feel good about myself, and it just felt much easier to get completely out of my head on Alcopops and things. How is your experience of, do you go out onto the LGBT scene, you know, to gay bars and things now that you're transitioned?
I used to, obviously, identifying as a gay guy, I used to go out before. Not that much. Like, I've never taken drugs, so I don't feel I should talk on that subject, like, because I don't have a right to, really, because I don't know what people are going through. But I would go out, but not loads. But, like, since transitioning, no, it's actually quite sad. Like, I'm going to go out tonight, hey, to heaven, because I got my wristband. But I don't know, like, I just felt like I never fit in, and that kind of comes down to the being transing, but I just never felt I fitted in because clearly, because I was trans, but at the time I didn't realize, but I just felt I was dancing on the floor like I was Beyonce and all the other guys were trying to get off of each other, and I was like, well, this is why I'm single, but this is also why I'm unhappy in myself, is because I want to be Beyonce. I'm not a gay guy. So like, after transitioning as well, I guess it's pretty similar. Like, I feel like I don't quite belong here nor there. Like, I don't really feel like I belong in gay clubs too much, but I also don't feel like I belong in straight clubs. And I don't want to go to trans clubs because they're dirty, but yeah, so I don't know.
I want to talk about perhaps sometimes do we make things a bit more difficult for ourselves. Do you think, you touched upon racism, have you experienced racism in, you know, from gay people? I know it's a bit of an obvious question.
It is obvious. Oh my God. You know, the thing is, it gets to a place. I think it happens automatically. You auto-tune yourself in a way and you just switch off. You can see it. And at that moment, you question yourself, okay, why really do I want to be bothered about this person? So you've gotten to a place where you don't feel it anymore. But unfortunately, that is a very, very sad place to be. The fact that pain is being inflicted on you and you can't feel pain anymore. It shows how much pain you have to bear to get to that point. And now, you know, when things... I remembered, I stopped going to Soho unless I'm going there for business because I'm tired. And the reason why I stopped going was one day I was walking down Old Compton Street, and there was this guy that just walked up to me and was chatting me up, and I was not interested. And he kept chatting me up, and the next thing he said was, oh, you should be lucky I'm talking to you in the first place. And I was like, you know, people like you, we just give them money. It's because of your cock. That's why I'm talking to you. Do you think? And, you know, I'm not on Grindr anymore. But you're on Grindr, you get messages like, oh, so you're black, you're hung. So I'm not a person. Within the gay community, I'm not seen as a person. And that is a big thing. Oh, you want to get into bar. And so many times I've been asked at GAY at the door, do you know this is a gay bar? And I'm like, really? It's 1 a.m. in the middle of the night. I'm standing in queue to get into this place. And you're asking me if I know this is a gay bar. Are you kidding me that I've left my bed, the comfort of my bed, to queue up for 30 minutes to get here, and you're telling me, you know, and these things are very subtle. And I can deal with it. You know, I can, but I look around me and I see young black gay people, and I just question how much these kids are having to deal with pop culture, with racism, with homophobia, with so many things at the same time. And do they have the necessary support network to be able to deal with it? Because importantly for me, I was never, never black until I came to this country. I was never black. It was when I got to this country, I became black. And in as much as I don't like to classify myself as black because of the baggage that comes with it, I see it as a process of empowerment for me. And I own it, I take it on board. It has really helped me, and I celebrate my blackness, but it's such a struggle.
Will, we've talked about schools and bullying and all those kind of things, but if anyone here is not feeling great about themselves, maybe recognizing some of the things that we're talking about, what would you suggest that they might do?
It's an exciting time. I've touched on tougher times for myself and things that can make things tough. And also, you know, I heard you say you had wonderful times on the gay scene, and you know, there are life is to be lived, and a healthy life is the most wonderful life. And it was interesting hearing you, Johnny, talk about, you know, the kindness of one stranger. You know, how amazing is that? Just one moment. And I watched the documentary. I thought it was beautiful. I think the key thing is to notice feelings in all of us. You know, I was talking to a friend earlier on the way here when I turned up to the wrong place. And, you know, mental health is a very restrictive term, I think. And like stretching out DNA, it just needs to be elongated and elongated. And the more support there is, the more that we're all allowed to see that we're allowed any feeling and we accept our own feelings, then we can hear other people's. You know, we are humans. I can be happy, I can be anxious, I can be lonely, and I can feel empowered all at the same time, and they're all valid. I will keep on coming back to education, because I think that's the grassroots level is where it will grow and become embedded. And that's why I'm really privileged and happy to be here today, you know, to share my views on it. Yeah.
Charlie, you mentioned earlier on about dealing with this kind of internalized dislike of yourself. How have you made steps forward to overcome that?
I've got a really interesting story of that, actually, because I don't know if any of you know about the process of transitioning through the NHS, but it's a very, very slow process. It just got talked about in the trans report that was done by the government recently, and I was on ITV News talking about. But it's very, very long, and it's going to change soon, hopefully. But I had to wait about 2 years before I started transitioning medically, and so that meant that for those 2 years, I was kind of in like a prison almost, like, but I was so much more positive because I knew I was, every day I'd wake up and I'd be one day closer to getting on hormones. So I'd be like, okay, I can do this, just keep going. And I was very suicidal, like I said, before transition, before accepting myself. But it's weird that in those 2 years, nothing changed. Like even now, I've only been on hormones 6 months. This is all padding and contour, honey, and a prayer. But like, so not much has changed. And I mean, not much has changed with my body in 2 years or just over 2 years. But I would like do things like every day, like I'd moisturize my body and I would like have my nails, like paint my nails, and I would like take vitamins and like just be good to myself and like try and love myself and work from the inwards. So even though I still had facial hair and I still have a receding hairline and I still had a penis, I loved myself because I was doing these little like iterations every day to just try and make myself accept myself. And I did, and I really do. Like if I can do it, anyone can. Like I have gone from, at one point, I made my family take down all the mirrors in the house. I'd have candles instead of lights. I thought I was so ugly. And now, like I said, not much has changed, but I've totally, totally loved myself.
Amazing. We've got to wrap it up very shortly. But Izzy, just in one sentence, what would you say to people who want help, who want to help with their mental health? And we'll just finish off.
I think if you need help, help is out there. If you don't talk about it, you will not find somebody who is going to help you. It's very important to know that you're not alone. You're not the only one. There's so many people, like Will said, it's a stretch. You know, there's a feeling that we all feel, but there is a deeper part of it. Go out, talk to somebody. Find somebody you can confide in. Reach out to somebody. It helped me. It saved my life. You know, and it's saving a lot of people's lives. Life is beautiful and it's for the living.
Yeah, we've all got mental health and we've all got mental ill health and we've all got physical health and we've got physical ill health and we've all got our identities and you know, who we identify with. And I think for me, the important thing is remember all the things that make you feel right within yourself, that make you feel comfortable, that make you feel happy, that bring you joy, and just remember those things for the times you are feeling down. If you're feeling really, really down, don't, you know, try to reach out, try to talk to a friend, talk to somebody you trust, you know, join support groups, talk to your doctor. At the worst way, go to A&E, scream, shout, stamp until you get heard, till you get seen, till you get someone to listen to you, and listen to others, and listen without labels, and listen to yourself as well. So,
Johnny, in one sentence, what would you suggest to people who might want help?
Well, first of all, never ever be embarrassed or ashamed about what goes on in here, because, you know, we can't control our thoughts and feelings, and what goes on in here, the brain is no different to the heart or the liver or the stomach, and just like you have, you know, a stomachache, you can't control it, and you can't control what goes on in here, so never feel embarrassed or ashamed about your thoughts and feelings, and just know that you can overcome. I believe you can overcome any adversity in life, whatever it is. And there's a great quote, which is, the human spirit is stronger than anything that can happen to it. So I truly believe that anyone with the right support, and the support is there, with the right support, with an outlet, can really overcome anything in life. I really believe it.
Absolutely. There's that very powerful statement about why suicide is never the right thing to do, which is that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. So I think that's always something to keep in your mind. It's also important to know there are people that you can go to. You can go to the NHS. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, certainly in London, you can go to Antidote, a London friend. You can Google them. There are various LGBT support groups. There's the Metro Centre. There's the LGBT Foundation in Manchester, the Leicester LGBT Centre, the Birmingham LGBT Centre, there are places all over the country. Life is short and it is for living, so do not suffer. If you don't feel good, you can do something about it. There's groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Crystal Meth Addicts Anonymous, who have huge LGBT, numbers of LGBT people who go to them, some LGBT specific groups. So do not be alone. And always remember, if things are really, really bad, there's always Samaritans. So please could you thank our panel, Johnny Benjamin, Taz Edward White, Issy Alimi, Charlie Craggs, and the lovely Will Young. Thank you for coming. Have a fantastic weekend.
Just want to say as well, if any of you guys are affected by any of these things that we've talked about, you can ring the Samaritans. The number is 116 123. So maybe just pop that in your phone in case you need it. 116 123.